if you could give me a brief overview of your work.
Sure. Well, as I said, I'm the associate director of the Global Negotiation Project, which is a project within the Program on Negotiation. And I mean, I sort of divide what I've done into, obviously, into the sort of practice component and then theory research. And I mean, from the practice component, I've had some fairly broad experiences doing negotiations as a representative of different organizations, from doing mediation in small claims court and other kinds of situations, also engaging in problem-solving workshops, a few different ones, particularly with Israelis and Palestinians, and having the opportunity to actually be a participant, which was a very unique and useful experience, especially trying to think about how to be a third party in those situations. And then also in victim-offender reconciliation programs. Did that for a few years. And that was a different kind of twist, but helped me to see the larger process of conflict, and particularly what we often talk about as a post-conflict kind of process with the reconciliation piece. I think that really helped me see the value of all that. So that, I mean, that's practice, and there's been a lot of varied different examples. And then I also was the chairman of the board of my mother's family's company. It's a land development company, and that took a lot of a lot of negotiation and other kinds of mediation work, particularly because it was with uncles and other people who continued to see you as a junior individual in the structure of the hierarchy. But in terms of sort of the theory practice, I mean, my biggest... I've done a lot on negotiation and mediation in general, but I would say that the realm that I spent the most time thinking about is sort of international negotiations and peace processes, and that's actually what my dissertation was focused on. It was on how mediators sequence issues in these large intractable conflicts, and so I've been doing a lot on that and what the different strategies are and how they're employed, et cetera, et cetera. But I've also focused on sort of guarantors, the idea of guarantors and peace processes, as well as I'm actually shifting now and beginning some work on humanitarian negotiations for workers in humanitarian crises. I've been working with a few colleagues who are experts on humanitarian issues, and I'm bringing the negotiation piece. So we're collaborating in an online class, a distance learning class for humanitarian workers.
That's cool. Is that a PLM project?
It is through the Global Negotiations Project, yeah. And I'm also working with a colleague to do a survey of humanitarian negotiators and why they may be struggling. You know, sort of, well, what are the characteristics of humanitarian negotiations specifically? Why aren't they as effective as they could be, and how might they be improved? And so we're planning on doing that with a place called the Center for Humanitarian Development in Geneva. And then the last piece of my early work was on sort of the prevention of conflict, destructive conflict at the international level, and the tension between preventive diplomacy, in essence, and sovereignty. And so that's sort of a broad overview. I mean, part of my philosophy has been to follow some of the things that have popped up in my life, and not be constrained by very narrowly defined what I'm interested in. I can mention a little bit more about that later.
Okay.
So that's an overview for you, fairly broad. But
yeah, it's actually a lot of different elements.
Yeah.
It's funny because most of the people that I've talked to have been more sort of narrowly focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, in some respects, it's kind of been a conscious choice. I feel like this field is big enough and broad enough that I think there should be specialists and there should be generalists.
Mm-hmm.
And I do see a lot of what I do as being a generalist. But, for example, I mean, my focus on peace processes is a place where I would say that's about as close to a specialization as I have. And that, particularly the negotiation mediation piece of a peace process. And so I think there's, from my perspective at least, that there's a lot of value in both approaches. You can contribute. I mean, the problem is that in life, I mean, every time I tell somebody what I do, they always say, so, well, oh boy, could I have used you last week, or whatever it might be. And so I also think it's important to be able to translate for people. And so it got me thinking about how this field fits in lots of different contexts. And in fact, I mean, the field itself is a multidisciplinary one. And so you delve into areas that you never thought you were going to be doing, you know, be engaged in. And for the book on the third side, the research that we did, I mean, I was learning about primates, I was learning about archaeology and anthropology, and, you know, when I started this, my background really is in international relations. So you, if you're open to it, it's kind of a grandiose liberal continuation of a liberal arts education, if you're willing to look at it that way. And I like that. I've always liked the fact that this field bridges disciplines, and I've always seen that as a positive, where, you know, some people think it's a negative, but anything that forces you to see the world in a different way, to me, is productive, even for people who think they're open-minded and very liberal in the way they do things. I just find it to be really engaging that a primatologist can look at a situation completely differently than I would have ever thought. Or, you know, a biologist, or, you know, I mean, I've even had an interest in dolphin behavior and how dolphins handle conflict and what can we learn from that kind of thing. So, you know, I mean, that may sound like a wild idea, but, and it is a wild idea, but if you don't probe into those places where people don't look, you're not going to find things that might actually help you in these situations where we're stuck. I mean, there are a lot of places where we're very good at what we do, and there are others where we're not, and we need to improve. And I think the only way you improve is by challenging conventional wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah, seeking out sort of a broader input.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience, and this can be practice or...
Yeah.
Or in your research, what has there been something that has particularly inspired you?
You know, I can't point to one specific kind of incident that said that transformed the way I saw things. But I think the very fact that when you work with people and they're very rigid when they start, and that they know the answer to the problem and they see the problem in one dogmatic way, and that's the way it has to be. And when you're able to help them move from that, that's something that you can't really explain what that's like. And so I think that the experience of seeing people change when they said that they would never change, or when they argued to you that there was no reason to change or no need to change, I think is a pretty powerful one. And, you know, I mean, I tend to believe that when you get people working together, I mean, a lot of the agreements that I've helped people reach were not ones that they ever conceived of before the process started. And I think that's part of the interest and the allure of all of this, is that it's just talking is not the solution. But when you get people into a room, it's far beyond, a lot of time, it's far beyond what they ever thought that they might get to. And I think that's, you know, getting them to talk is a piece of the puzzle. There's a lot more to it. But those changing attitudes and beliefs, it's really amazing to see that happen, particularly, you know, when people come in such a rigid way. Maybe I'm naive about this, but I'm not convinced that, you know, people always say, well, those people are too old to change. I don't really believe that. I mean, I've seen people who were in the military who are now in this field who really see that things are different, and they're 60, 70 years old. So they've obviously seen it differently. And so, yeah, I think it gets harder to change because of habituation and other kinds of things. But in general, I mean, you obviously have to be an optimist to be in this field. Or at least that's my perspective on it.
Any particular experiences of your work that have been very rewarding? It's related to the last question.
Yeah, I think it's always rewarding when people say to you, well, that they thank you for your help. I mean, when I've had situations, particularly mediating, where people have been working on a problem or not really working well on a problem for 6 months, and in an afternoon or a day or two, you're able to actually help them get there. I think we all know how debilitating conflict can be. And so helping people get there, that's our role, is to help them. It's not, ultimately these are their problems. And I do sort of stick to that underlying principle that these are their problems, and I'm there to just see if I can't make it a little bit easier for them to get there. But they're that much more appreciative if you can help them. I think it's I think I got into this because I enjoyed kind of working with people and helping people. And so every time you do that, it's very gratifying. And I'd say particularly in my teaching experience, when people come up to you and say, I wish I had had this course 20 years ago because it would have changed my life, then you get a pretty good sense that you're doing something right. I don't take that to mean, wow, you're something special. I take it to mean that the skills associated with this field are very valuable for people. And in fact, that's why I think it's taken off the way it has, because people see value in it. And I think it's rewarding for me in the sense that I feel like people are validating the field and the worthiness of the field. I believe in it, so I don't really need people to tell me that they really think it's helpful. But I'm impressed at the wide array of people who get involved in all of this and who see the value in it. And I think that holds a lot of optimism for the future about where this all can go. Because, if you think about a wave, I just see this field as not even halfway on the way up to the crest. I think there's a there's a lot more to go in terms of being at a pinnacle somewhere. So I have a lot of optimism for it. And there's a tremendous amount of work to do. All I have to do is look around.
You mentioned that you had done work on the sequencing of international agreements.
Yeah.
How does sequencing affect the course of negotiation?
Well, I should probably just explain what I mean by sequencing, because there are a few different conceptions out there. The reason I actually chose to study this topic for my dissertation was because I felt like it was a very understudied, almost assumed kind of idea, particularly in that larger intractable conflict realm. And what I mean by sequencing is that mediators tend to have a plan in their head about how to go about ordering the issues involved, and really about when to deal with the most contentious issues as the parties define them in the process. So in other words, the general traditional way in those intractable conflicts is what I call the gradualism approach, just incremental step-by-step kind of thing. Like the Oslo process is a very good one between the Israelis and Palestinians. It's a very good example of that.
Which means you start small,
you start with the easier issues and you work your way up to the harder ones eventually. That's the theory behind it all. And it makes sense. There's not trust between the parties, et cetera, et cetera. But in the literature, I kept seeing that this was the way you would do it, and I never really saw a deep analysis of, A, what do we mean by sequencing, and B, are we sure that that's the only way to do this? I guess if there's anything that I would say kind of characterizes some of my work, it's to look at the fundamental assumptions that we make about different processes and to ask if those are accurate or not. And with regard to sequencing, I just wasn't convinced that it was. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't think a gradual process can't work. I think that sequencing absolutely can work and is something that, in a gradual way, can work. But I think it depends. I think, most people in this field, if they work on divorce mediations or more interpersonal kinds of things, a gradual approach may very well be the best. But I think part of the decision about how to sequence issues is dependent on the context of the conflict. It's dependent on the relationship between the parties. There are a lot of variables, and so what I kind of set out to do was to say, is this in fact the only way to try to make peace in these situations? And what I ended up finding was that there are actually three sort of main models on how to do this. And there were a few more peripheral ones that need some more research, but could quite possibly be other models. And so I think there isn't a way to sequence negotiations. I think that's point number one. And I think a lot of the way in which people try to sequence these issues depends on their experience in the past, habituation. You know, I mean, if they view something in the past and it succeeded, and we do this in everyday life, it's tended to work, or that's our approach in general until it disproves itself. And so,
which is fairly limiting. I mean, you would contend in that sense that if you only
I would, because I there are some conflicts that different processes have been tried and the level of frustration is high. Let me just use Oslo for an example, because the core of the conflict, the final status issues, were left essentially to be dealt with at a later date. And there was an attempt to get there, but the reality was that they never really got to the final status issues. And by the time that they were making the attempt, there was a lot of frustration on the ground as to the fact that, you know, they've been fighting for some decades, and the core of what they're fighting about hasn't really been addressed. And so the gradual approach that, I mean, one of the premises of the gradual approach is that you build trust along the way. And the problem is that there are a lot of spoilers and other people who don't want the process to succeed. And on one level, I felt like the gradual approach doesn't really take that into consideration. Or if it does, it minimizes the importance of that. And, you know, one thing that I believe in is that there is a natural momentum once you sign a peace agreement. And I think one of the conclusions, or tentative conclusion, that I came away from with my dissertation was you don't have to resolve the core issues in the conflict right away. But I think what you have to do is you have to start working on them and show the people on the ground who ultimately make this thing work or not that progress is being made on those issues. Or their ability to support the process or their desire to support the process is going to wane quickly. A, and B, you also have to make certain that some changes are happening on the ground so people can see that their lives are improving from peace processes. And so, you know, gradual approaches don't often tend to do a lot of that. And in fact, you know, one of the premises behind it is, and I go back to Oslo for a minute, one of the premises was the sort of Oslo spirit that was developed in the negotiation process. And that's fine between the parties involved, but the societies, very little was done to bring the societies along in the same way.
Or, sort of
yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, because they're the ones who, are, they're the bridges that are going to make this thing stick when problems exist. And in fact, I mean, I heard similar complaints about the process in Northern Ireland, that there really seems to be a gap between the people at the top who negotiate the agreement and the people, unfortunately, at the bottom who will either support it, who need to support it and maintain it and sustain it over time. And so, you know, sequencing, I mean, I think, you know, if you were, you know, one of the other strategies that I borrowed the term from McCormick, who was talking about it in a public policy context, is that the other approach is sort of a boulder in the road approach, where there's one of the major issues is at the beginning, or it's a boulder that needs to be moved before anything else can really happen, and that you can't work your way up to it. And I mean, a good example of that was apartheid in South Africa. I mean, it was fairly hard to not do away with apartheid before you would deal with everything else. And you know, to be fair, I mean, they reverted to more of a boulder in the road process after they had tried gradual approaches that didn't really seem to get them there. So there's almost a sequencing of sequencing strategies, or there can be. Mm-hmm. And then in Northern Ireland and in other places, there was sort of a committee approach where instead of trying to deal with easy to hard or hard to easy, they determined what the core issues were in the conflict and kind of divided the teams to deal with them simultaneously and move forward with the agreement that there was no agreement until everything was agreed to, basically. And there are a few others. But those were the sort of three dominant ones that emerged. And part of the reason why I think it's helpful to have that is because now the mediator can look at a situation and say, okay, I know in the past I've used a gradual approach, but let me gauge the level of frustration here. How many issues are involved in this problem? And if that, in fact, is the case, maybe one of these other strategies is worth trying. I mean, you know, the gradual approach is one that is safer, and it is also one that the more dominant party tends to want to use because they can control it easier.
Because they don't have to make big concessions on
right.
the issues?
Right, exactly. And whereas the boulder in the road approach is one that it's sort of high risk, high gain. That if the process collapses, it's going to be hard to start a new one, and it might, in fact, even lead to renewed fighting. You know, it's hard to know. So there are different challenges with each one, but I think it, you know, my dissertation was, in some ways, at least in my mind, was a way of laying a foundation to really study this topic, because people had mentioned it, but there wasn't really a deep kind of assessment of it all. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's how I perceived it, was to try to lay a foundation for more study. And there's a lot more. I mean, you know, obviously the value at the end of the day is to say, okay, so which sequencing strategy is most appropriate in which conflict? Well, okay, that's obviously preferable, and if I could do that, I probably wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be, you know, advising some people. And the problem is that the nature of peace processes is that there are so many variables involved that sequencing is one. It doesn't determine success, but I will tell you for sure that if you don't get the sequencing right, it's certainly going to lead to failure. It's sort of an unknown that
if you get it right,
nobody notices.
Right.
If you get it right, nobody notices. If you don't get it right, it can collapse a process. It's like, I mean,
and how do you know you had it right if it didn't work anyway?
Potentially, it may not have been the cause of the failure, but it could be. And I mean, you know, the best analogy that I can give, if I was explaining this to the layperson, is to say, look, when you get up in the morning, you don't put your shoes on first, right? Because then you can't get your pants on. If you realize that, you put your pants on first, and then you put your shoes on. And after a while, it becomes second nature, and it becomes something that you do, and you don't think about it. And that's sort of what sequencing is about, that it's a hidden kind of issue, and until it doesn't work, you don't notice it. Mm. And so I think that was part of my purpose, was to draw attention to this, the fact that that's how we see sequencing as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned three major sequencing approaches, mm-hmm. and then when you mentioned that first one, you sort of came up with a new one, or at least one that you didn't mention again, which is that you take the big issue and start working on it earlier, along with the graduated other stuff.
Well,
So waiting for the lump at the end, you sort of start chopping away at it from the beginning.
Well, the three models really are the gradual, the incremental one, step by step to the larger. Then really kind of the boulder in the road issue, which is you deal with the hardest issue and try to get that out of the way. And then you go easier. The third one is the committee one. And in some respects, I mean, what I think I'm advocating is, in the way that you were describing it, what I was really talking about is in the gradual process, I'm not even saying change the gradual process. What I'm saying is change the way that you think about the core issues, and that it might still be a good thing to have some confidence-building measures and issues in a gradual process, but don't leave the final status issues for much later. Like, make them part of the gradual process. Mm-hmm. You know, start to build, you know, maybe when you're looking at some of the core issues in the conflict, see which ones could be broken down further, fractionated, and then have people start working on elements of those. I mean, you know, again, if you wanted to go back to the issue of Jerusalem, there are a number of facets in the issue of Jerusalem that, you know, when you're talking about sovereignty or civil authority, you know, how the city itself is going to function, et cetera, that people could have been making progress on and thinking through, so that maybe down the road, when people started talking about Jerusalem, it wasn't such a taboo, because issues are essentially held at sacred, and the longer you avoid talking about them, the more weight they take on and the more mysterious they remain. When you start to break them down and you start to think about them and you start to operationalize the different pieces of them, they're not so daunting. I mean, they're,
you know, more familiarity, there's more fear of actually speaking the word or using the name of whatever the hard topic is.
Right. And then there are actually others that are designed, in essence, to almost avoid the question of sequencing. I interviewed President Carter as part of my dissertation, and he said that he used a single negotiating text approach to actually avoid sequencing, to avoid the question, that he'd much rather do it in one large text. And as he said, sequencing became irrelevant for the parties because they saw that their issue was involved. Now, you know, how it all is going to fit itself in the implementation is a bit different than your plan for the actual negotiation process. But that is, I mean, that's another way in which somebody tried to handle the sequencing question differently. And we don't think about, I mean, most people don't think about the single negotiating text approach as a way of dealing with sequencing. And so part of what I'm trying to get at is that it's there. It's kind of like the elephant in the room. And I just wanted to sort of shine a light on it and say, we need to think about this in a different way and give mediators, give parties, give whomever else choices instead of just thinking there's one way to do this, because that's, as we've seen in general in conflict, that's very debilitating and it doesn't often get us where we want to be.
Mm. Have you been able to advocate the sort of alternative graduated approach and seen it in use at all? Have you been able to do any research about that?
It's interesting because I would definitely want to be careful about saying that, you know, one approach is better than another or whatever it might be. I mean, because, for example, in Mozambique, the gradual approach worked fairly well there, actually. So I would certainly say that, you know, I would start with that premise that just because it didn't work somewhere doesn't mean it can't work somewhere else. I haven't seen... I think there are different instances. In Burundi, Mandela used really what I would term a boulder in the road approach. And that was really after a lot of gradual approaches had been tried. And I mean, one of the nice things about the boulder in the road approach is it kind of says to the people in the process, the parties of the process, we're going to be able to determine whether the other party is serious or not very quickly. Because if they're not willing to agree to this large issue, or at least to engage in talking about it, then you know they're not serious about this process. And one of the problems with peace processes is that people use them as tools and manipulation. So, and that's one of the bigger problems about gradualism, is that more powerful parties can use them to manipulate the parties, the weaker party. And the boulder in the road approach, or other approaches that really almost try to bind people with commitments, kind of like Schelling talked about a long time ago, that gets you to another level and allows the parties to say, I knew they weren't serious about it, or wow, I'm surprised that they would make that commitment and show their seriousness. So there's also that element of it that's important.
So it sounds like you're beginning to line up a schema of when certain approaches might be more useful. In other words, if there's a large asymmetry in the power between the parties negotiating, you might not advocate, or I don't know if you'd advocate another one, but you might say probably the graduated approach has large potential for abuse in this case.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, I actually made a distinction in my dissertation. There's an economic concept of a palliative versus creative gradual approaches. A lot of this stuff came from economic change and also political science about how leaders should govern. And in fact, Henry Kissinger, who is the sort of poster child for the gradual approach, if I could put it that way, he very clearly said that gradual processes were preferable because they could be managed much easier, and statesmen don't have to make the kind of commitments that statesmen don't like to make, the big ones. You know, they want to go from 4 years to 4 years or whatever the election cycle is, and so it's much easier to manipulate. But one offshoot that I am going to explore is how can you tell when a creative gradual approach is happening. Creative meaning, you know, people genuinely want to be in it, as opposed to a palliative, which is a false process.
Sort of good faith versus...
Like what might be some benchmarks or indicators that people could look for?
And I mean,
I would want to be, again, those are tentative conclusions. I do think that is a dynamic of why parties agree to engage in a peace process with regard to power and why they want to use a gradual approach. And, you know, sometimes it's hard because the approach and the process usually needs to mirror at least some of the things on the ground, at least some of the dimensions and dynamics on the ground, or a more powerful party isn't going to do it. And so the challenge is to keep the more powerful party engaged and not have the less powerful party feeling like they're getting just steamrolled into everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it does, so power is clearly a dynamic at play here, and I think, you know, it probably will change, and I think that's an area for more research.
Yeah. A work in progress.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see, so we knocked out a couple of these. Should we talk about obstacles? Is that something that's
interesting
to talk about?
Okay. Yeah.
So what are
yeah.
some common obstacles to a successful... Well, yeah, as long as we talk about international peace agreements, let's keep on answering.
Okay.
That's something I haven't had a lot of people talk about yet. So,
uh-huh.
So in terms of international peace agreements, what are some of the most comical?
Well, I think in most negotiation processes in general, rigidity is probably one of the biggest obstacles. And so, you know, and most people come into a situation, I think we're not hardwired for this, but we've learned it, that, and I think most people who don't think deeply about negotiation processes come in with one way and one idea of how to resolve the problem, and it's their way. And so a significant challenge is to show people that there are multiple routes to getting where you want to be. And to pry them away from this sort of my way or the highway approach. So I definitely think that's one. I think the sort of managing of emotions is another that makes its way in to most negotiation processes. And in fact, I mean, most, you know, there was this long period where people said, you know, don't have your emotions kind of thing. And in fact, that's obviously not what makes a process go. It's having your emotions constructively, and most people don't have the skills or knowledge to do that, and I think that sort of leaks into the next thing, which is sort of communication skills. I mean, the reality is, and why the field continues to grow, is because people don't have the skills and they don't really know how to do this stuff. And, I mean, you know, international peace agreements or intrastate peace agreements, which is the nature of a lot of them now, are between, you know, they're on a fixed piece of land, and they're between insurgents and a government, or you know, however you want to define them. I mean, people will say freedom fighter and not, you know, whatever.
Terrorist and
yeah, and so I mean that's a particular dynamic that's you know, and so another obstacle is the conferring of legitimacy on these groups to be part of a process. I mean, once you started a peace process, you've conferred a certain amount of legitimacy on them, and so. A lot of people will make the case that the hardest part of all of this is to get the parties to the table, because you're breaking down barriers. I mean, with the Israelis and Palestinians, you know, Israelis could not talk to the PLO. It was illegal. It was forbidden by Israeli law. So that's a fairly large challenge. I mean, we can't engage in a peace process officially. That's why Oslo evolved the way Oslo did, because officially we couldn't do it, or you know, we, the Israelis. And so, you know, I think those are some other dynamics. I mean, you know, we talked about power and people's perception of power. It's usually perception of power is greater than the reality. And a lot of times, you know, the perception of the more powerful, the perception is, that, particularly in intrastate conflicts, those kind of conflicts, is that you know, the more powerful party, it's often billed that they've got all the choices, and the less powerful party has no choices, and that's not true, because if there was no choice for the lesser party, I mean, then why are they at the table? There's a reason that they're there, and the weaker party needs to understand that and needs to think about different ways of influencing the other party. And part of it, again, is how they see the situation, how they see their plight. And reasonably, I mean, if I'm a Palestinian living in Gaza or West Bank on tiny swaths of land, I don't see a whole lot of hope. But there are different ways of doing things. And obviously, the recognition of the right of the state of Israel, et cetera, were things that the Israelis valued that the Palestinians could give them. So I think the perception of power is clearly a block that needs to be overcome by the people. And then, I mean, two others, I would say that people tend to see value narrowly in most negotiations, but I guess you could argue in peace processes as well, that we define value, you know, in monetary terms or whatever it might be, when there's lots of different ways of seeing value. And that's where a lot of creative ideas and solutions come forward.
Is that sort of expanding the pie?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's interesting. I can relate it to a story that I was just reading in the paper a couple weeks ago about an old woman who lived in Vermont who was selling her home. And she ended up having an offer from a couple who offered her a substantial amount, and she also got an offer from a single guy, who offered a lot less, and she decided to sell the house to the single guy. And this reporter, somehow the reporter got a hold of the story and said to her, "Why would you do that?" And the older woman said, "Because I really got a sense that he would take care of my house the way I would have." Now, you know, most people would say, "Okay, lady, you know, you should have taken more money." But money is not the only way that people see value. There's sentimentality, there's symbolism, there's all kinds of things that play into why peace processes happen and how they can evolve and move forward, and in negotiations in general. And so I think it's that seeing value in different ways that enable that. Seeing value narrowly is the obstacle. Helping people see value in a much broader capacity is clearly a way of moving a process forward. And then I think the last thing is that most people don't take the time to prepare. And this goes for any negotiation in general. I mean, mediators might, but parties in a peace process, I mean, they don't take the time because they're not sure how to prepare. I mean, you know, it goes back to that, but again, I'm one of the kind of persons that thinks that 80 to 90% of what happens in a negotiation is a direct result of how you've prepared for the negotiation. And so I would say, I mean,
what sort of preparations are you talking about?
Well, I mean, I think you have to make a concrete effort to understand your interests very clearly, what it is that you have to get out of this, and what are you willing to sacrifice? I mean, you know, because processes, you don't make peace or you don't reach agreement with people unless there are things that you're willing to give up. And the reality is that some people value certain things higher than others. And so the first thing is being very clear about what it is that you want, because a lot of people aren't clear about what they want to get out of a process. And then, you know, clearly thinking about, I mean, what keeps people at the table most often is, you know, what their alternatives are to the process. And obviously we know particularly with regard to peace processes, that they've either reached a mutually hurting stalemate or a mutually enticing opportunity or whatever other concept you want to throw out there. Alternatives are absolutely essential. I mean, I don't care what negotiation you're doing or what process you're involved in. If you don't know what's waiting for you when you walk out the door, then you don't have any way of gauging whether you ought to accept what's happening. I mean, it's a basic, the BATNA is the basic concept here. And it's probably one of the more valuable things that people have taken, you know, I think that people have taken away from the field, is it's really critical to know what that is.
When you say people need to know their interests, that sort of assumes that they know the difference between what they want and what their interest is, right? I mean, in terms of, that's sort of like getting to yes talk in that sense, right?
Because it is.
You know, and if I say I want X, and that's what I'm going in with, you're going to tell me, well, why do you want X? And that's really what you want, you know, is the why do you want X, not the X itself.
I think it's both. I think you want it, and there's also a reason why you want it. And I think it's important that you understand both. Yeah. I mean, but actually, I mean, more concretely, a lot of times people go into a process and they're really not positive. When somebody says, what is it that you really want from this process? They're not 100% sure they can answer that accurately. And so you actually have to give time to thinking about what is it that I really actually want to get out of this. And I know it sounds strange, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies at every level. But then you also have to think about, you have to think about the context of the negotiation. What's the atmosphere like and the history between the people? Again, if we're talking about peace agreements. And then power, obviously, how that impacts the situation. What kind of power do you have? Do you have any allies? Do you have coalitions? Are there ways in which you can try to deal with the power imbalance a little bit? And then thinking through, I mean, process, like, one of the biggest sticking points in peace process negotiations is reintegration, is disarmament and reintegration of soldiers. And that is an incredibly difficult one, and one that people are continuing to have a hard time trying to figure out how to do it. And, you know, I mean, that may, in terms of preparation, that might require you to do a lot of study, of a lot of research, and to go in depth and do interviews with soldiers and say, you know, how can we reintegrate you and find out the best ways to get you back into society so that you don't feel the need to pick up a gun, blah, blah, blah. So that's, I mean, that's another piece of the preparation kind of thing. And then different things like race and gender and what all those dynamics have to play, and culture. You know, have people's culture been trounced on in the process? Have historical sites been destroyed without knowledge of why they were important? You know, that kind of stuff are the elements that people really need to think about before they get in the room. And then, once you've done all that about yourself and the dynamics, then you need to start thinking about the other party and how you're going to satisfy the other. Now, that is partly a guessing game, but it's also, you should have, I mean, when we go into processes, we have educated guesses about how people will do things. And if you don't have educated guesses, then you're never going to be able to anticipate what's going to happen and ways in which you might respond. I mean, the goal is to try to figure out how you might deal with something that will come up. So you have to, I mean, it's like, you know, it's really like anything, that if you thought about, and sometimes we do this to the point of obsession, in fact, to a debilitating point where we don't raise conflicts or issues in conflicts, because we're so concerned about what the other might say, or how they might say it, or what the conflict, you know, it's intrapsychically.
Keeping the relationship steady.
Yeah, mm-hmm. All those kinds of things. And that absolutely happens, too. And it's a useful process as long as you channel it in a way that's productive instead of destructive. Most people do it, and they're afraid to raise it, so they don't bring up anything. What I advocate and what I try to counsel people to do is make that into a productive kind of thing, where you're trying to anticipate what the other wants and needs to get out of this process, and how you can help them do that. I mean, if you can find, instead of one way to do that, if you could think of what the other person's interests are, and you know what their BATNA is, and there are five routes that you've come up with in order to help them achieve that, chances are one of those is going to be acceptable to them. So it's that.
Like you, the negotiator? Or
you,
party A talking to party B?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's incumbent on you to think about, you know, negotiation. You can't achieve what you want. I mean, that's a fundamental tenet of all of our field, is that you can't achieve what you want without the other's help in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And so you have to spend as much time thinking about what the other wants, needs, their situation is, as you do yours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a bunch of obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could talk about circumstances that you have either been involved in or known about in your research.
Yeah.
Where those obstacles have been overcome.
I mean,
personal experience or from, you know, the various peace agreements that you've done research on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think certainly the best one about, particularly with regard to power and with regard to engaging in the process, is the PLO. I mean, my understanding was that the PLO didn't see much reason nor value to get involved in a peace process, because they just didn't feel like they had any way of influencing the situation. And when they began to realize that they had this ability to recognize Israel, et cetera, et cetera, and other places of value, that kind of changed the dynamic for them, and they saw it as something that it was worth doing. In terms of, I think that's probably one of the better examples of how they overcame power. I mean, I think one of the jobs of a mediator in these particular kind of contexts is to help the parties go through this process of understanding what they want specifically. I mean, you know, the first step in any mediation process really is to sharpen the conflict. It's to really figure out exactly where the parties conflict, and that essentially exists at every level, because people most often come and they see a conflict quite differently, and so you have to get out exactly how the parties see it and then whittle down from there. And so in that sense, you know, the job of the mediator is to help them through the process, because most of the time people don't know about a lot of these skills. I mean, some do and some are very savvy, but in a lot of these processes, I mean, you had, particularly with regard to insurgents and groups and other groups, freedom fighters, however you want to call it, I mean, they've spent the last decade, you know, fighting and not thinking about how to make peace. And there's a real transition as well. You know, the ANC really struggled with that in South Africa, about moving from a protest-oriented organization to a political party. And so there's this transition about how they do that and how do they continue to kind of negotiate change from there. So, I mean, one of the ways in which a lot of the parties, particularly in Mozambique, you know, the community of St. Egidio, who helped to mediate that conflict, they were very good at helping the parties to think through those different processes. And, you know, I mean, a place like Mozambique, I mean, they had some factors that were helping that push them to the table. And they had a famine that was tragic and almost drove the parties together in a way that might not have happened. And in some ways, you have to seize on those kinds of things that make the process that can help transform a society, so that, you know, more violence and more chaos don't continue.
Mm. So those are moments. I mean, that's an interesting point. You're starting to get into sort of opportunities for change and mm-hmm. maybe a certain, well, I guess in this sense it would be a narrow understanding of what ripeness is, right? You see a certain moment and you can jump on it, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, ripeness is a funny concept.
I almost didn't want to use it.
That's like okay. That. It's funny in the sense that many people see value in it and its usefulness. And, I mean, I think opportunities might be, I don't know if it's more accurate, but it doesn't carry the same kind of connotation.
No.
And I think that there are fairly clear indicators about when situations change that might make things a little bit easier or better for a process to engage.
Right, to extend the olive branch.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, Jeff Rubin talked about how do you sort of help ripen a conflict. I mean, one of my concerns with ripeness is that we just kind of sit around and wait and not try to make the process better, or help get the parties to a point where they actually want to be part of a negotiation process. We just kind of sit back and we might let them fight it out because we keep saying it's not ripe. And I like the idea of thinking about how to ripen, like, fruit, you know, put it in the sun, right? Well, you know, that's the kind of thinking that I think is instructive. It says, well, you know, there's something to ripeness here, so can we help create conditions that make it more ripe for the parties? To me, that's a lot more constructive than just saying, well, let's, you know, get it when it's ripe, because you don't know until after the fact whether it's been ripe or not. And then if it doesn't work, you could say it wasn't ripe.
So we know
it's a tautological problem, but it's still, I mean, I wouldn't in any way discount it out of hand, because I do think it's an important idea, a useful concept for us to think about, and maybe, you know, the better way of thinking about it is how do we, if that in fact is true, then how do we help to enhance the conflict and make it so that the parties want to engage in a process?
Mm.
You know.
Easy questions, right?
Yes, very easy.
Let's see here. One thing I didn't have written down here, but that I wanted to ask you is what sort of... well, and this might not... I mean, God, it's such a large, you know, a high-level mm-hmm. stuff we're talking about. But if what sort of characteristics do you think that negotiators or some sort of third party, be it the UN uh-huh. or a private, you know... a group of academics like Oslo or something like that.
Yeah.
What sort of qualities do you think that they should have to be engaged in a process like this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they have to be persistent. I mean, there are a lot of places during the process where you think it's over, where it's frustrating, where the parties, you know, seem so intransigent and you just don't know what to do, blah, blah, blah. I think, you know, people who seem to succeed at this, they trust the process. They trust what they're doing, and they're incredibly persistent. They're creative. They're, I think they also, this gets into some sort of, I think, general advice for a lot of people in the field itself, but they also exhibit by their own behavior what, you know, what they want the parties to do. And they know when to say, they know when not to say things. I think that's kind of a big one that a lot of times when you mediate, I think people feel like they have to have all the answers for the parties, and you don't. You have to be able to ask the questions, appropriate questions, and you have to know when to stay out of it and let the parties, you know, work their way through a problem. And so I think those different characteristics generally are what make people who mediate these intractable conflicts successful. You know, I mean, I think you really have to believe in what you're doing. And I think also people who tend to realize that at the end of the day, if they fail, the consequences are so severe that they, you know, that it becomes a personal motivation, a drive within them to make sure that that doesn't happen. So I would think that those would be, you know.
Yeah.
These processes are, I mean, they're grueling. They're often processes that take many months, if not years, to really nail down everything. And when you've got people, you know, really acting in petty, frustrating ways, I mean, it's very easy to just throw your hands up and say, you know, these people just don't want to do this. And the ones that are able to do this are people who, you know, somehow they find ways of channeling that frustration and not taking it back out on the parties themselves. I mean, I think it's appropriate at times to say, to turn the mirror on them and say, look at how this is going, look at how you're acting. You know, this is not going to get you where you want to be. And I think that's easier to do when you have status, you know. And it's a risky thing to do, but, you know, sometimes when parties are behaving in a manner that's, you know, that's really frustrating, you know, they might need something to jar them out of that behavior, because that's what they've been doing to this point. And, you know, part of it is to let them go and then say, you know, this is not going to get us, you know, we outlined some goals, clear goals and guidelines about where we wanted to go and how we wanted to get there. And, you know, this isn't going to get us there. So we can keep going this way if that's your preference, but it's not going to get us there. And I think in general those are the different characteristics that people that successful people have. I mean, there's obviously more and different. It varies from context to context, but in general.
Well, there's a couple other questions on here.
Sure.
Are you particularly interested in answering either one of them? I have another question for you, which is has more to do with your sort of, you know, I don't want to say convergence to the field, but, you know, at some point there was this work, you know, we talk a lot about transformation and changing people's positions and their rigidity and things
yeah.
like that. And at some point you bought into all of this. And I wonder when that was and what experience made you believe in it. I mean, you mentioned teaching earlier, that's when you get your PhD, but...
Well, I think my initial my initial kind of why I got into this in the first place, well, there are a couple, two, I would say two reasons. I mean, the first was that my grandmother, she left Poland when she was 13 and her whole family died in the Holocaust. And so, of course, that was something that I didn't understand and tried to understand. And my undergraduate degree kind of focused on the Holocaust and Vietnam, actually, those two eras, to try to understand them. So, I mean, I think there was a familial thing that was planted in me that I wasn't fully aware of. And then after I graduated from college, a friend of mine said, hey, I'm buying a round-the-world ticket, and I'm going to travel for a year. Do you want to come? And I thought, gee, that'd be great. You know, I'm not sure I'll ever get a chance to do that again. And so I sold everything I owned and did it. And I found myself in lots of places with lots of destructive conflict all around me. The disparity between peoples and places was more than I ever imagined, particularly in Asia. I mean, Asia was a place. I spent 2 weeks in Calcutta, a couple blocks from Mother Teresa's mission, and that few weeks kind of just altered the way I saw everything. I mean, it doesn't take much to do that, and I found myself kind of on a train in the former Yugoslavia when the war was just getting started, and seeing, you know, young guys going off to fight and blah blah blah, and wondering. Yeah, I mean, one could characterize them as naive thoughts, but they are, you know, if you really break them down, they're actually the core of all the things that we do. And the naive questions are still questions I don't have answers to.
Like what?
Well, I mean, why would people engage in warfare when it so destroys everything that they built, thought, wanted for themselves and their family? I remember being in Sarajevo. I was an election monitor a few times, and I was in Sarajevo once, and I remember standing there in 97. I had just started at ICAR. And going around and looking at all the buildings and looking at all the different places that had been utterly destroyed and thinking what that city must have looked like before that and why it was that people had to resort. I mean, again, this is a naive, fundamental question. Why it is that people feel like they have to resort to this kind of abstract destruction in order to achieve their goals. And I still, I mean, there are a tremendous amount of reasons why not to. There are, you know, still some reasons why to that I can understand. But I don't accept the idea of human nature as being the reason. I just, you know, to me, human nature is something that everybody does. Every human being has the capacity to do. And I've met a lot of people who don't have the capacity to engage in warfare or kill. And so, you know, to me, we throw around the idea of human nature like we all know what it is. And I don't have the foggiest idea what human nature is. I wish I did. But, you know, so it's these large, grandiose questions that I can't answer, that I still can't answer, and I'm sure I'll never be able to answer. But that continue to get me, I mean, to continue to get me thinking about why these things happen. And, you know, so in any event, so I think those two things had the biggest impact on me. And then I went to American and did my master's there and just fell in love with the idea of conflict resolution. It was sort of felt like it was something I was doing my whole life anyways. Mm-hmm. And then really just got into it very much from there, and so it's kind of a long answer, but
yeah,
that was what did it. And then, I mean, it's very quick, you know, you can quickly move into believing in this stuff, especially when you see it work. I mean, once you've seen it work one or two times, then there's no way not to really kind of realize that it's possible. And it's not going to work in every instance. You know, there are some destructive conflicts that are going to make their way out there, and we're not going to be able to do anything about it, which is unfortunate, but true. I still think that there are a lot that we can deal with, and whether we like it or not, we'll never be out of work. So.
Do you want to talk? I've taken up more time than I said I would already.
That's okay. I can talk. Do you want me to talk? Let me. Why don't I just give you the unplug?
No,
we're good. All right. I mean, basically, why don't I just go through in terms of the last two? How's that? Six and seven?
Yeah, great.
In terms of advice, I mean, again, I would say that in order to succeed in this field, and I'll let whomever is listening to decide what success is, you have to be persistent. I mean, it's not a field where my dad was a doctor, and you know, it was very clear that you went to medical school and you did your residency and blah, blah, blah. Like, it was just the path was laid out for you. It doesn't work that way in this field. And so you need to understand that, and you need to be persistent about it. You need to be creative. You need to not be afraid to suggest why you could do something and how you could do it and how you might make a difference doing it. And so, you know, when people tell you things at face value, that's fine and you should accept them, but you should also think about creativity and how you could creatively kind of make yourself available and make yourself into a position. I mean, that's, you know, some of the jobs that I've had were jobs that I essentially kind of created and suggested to people, and they said, okay. So, you know, I think you would, some of the current work that I'm doing with Bill is about how to say no in a negotiation and still kind of get there. And most people are very afraid of saying no. And it's funny, the guy over here, Bob Bourdon, has a quote on his door that says, if you don't ask, if you ask and somebody says no, you feel stupid for 5 minutes. If you don't ask, you feel stupid for your whole life. And so I think one piece of advice is ask. The worst thing that somebody can say is no. And they will say no. And, you know, another piece of advice is that you need to have a sort of tough skin in this field, that you're going to get rejected, like every other field, but maybe, and it's not that this field is tougher than others, but it is something that, you know, there aren't as many jobs as there are people who would like them, and so clearly that's another. Definitely walking the talk. You can't, or at least try to walk the talk. I'm not even saying that you're going to succeed every time. I mean, I don't, and but I try, and so it's very hard to actually be in this field, to teach people principles and other things when you're not doing them. They can see that very quickly, and so any credibility that you might have is gone. In addition to that, I would say don't sacrifice your principles. I mean, if your principles tell you, you know, that X, Y, and Z is important, you know, I think, for example, for me, when I got my PhD, there was more opportunity to go into the business world and make a lot more money. And you know, that's attractive, especially, you know, I have a wife and a daughter, and I've got another child on the way. And there are days I think, gee, maybe, you know, a six-figure income would be nice. But that's not what I want for my life, and I realize, and there's an allure of that's hard to, you know, follow. And the last one is to kind of go with the flow of opportunity. I think we all have ideas of the different parts of the field that we want to work in, and I know, for example, that different projects took me in different ways that I never really thought I would go in, and I found a lot of value for that. I mean, there's a core of what I'm interested in and what I like, and that doesn't change, but I'm not afraid to kind of delve into realms that I don't know a lot about. And then lastly, it's not being afraid to learn from people of other disciplines, because people see conflict in other disciplines in a very different way. And generally, people are afraid of that. So those are that's my advice. And then the last thing, some important lessons. I don't think it's enough to do good. I think people get into this field saying that they want to do good, and that's great, but you really have to be prepared. You have to do your homework. You have to, it's like anything else. It's certainly noble to want to do good and to help the world in some way, shape, or form, or help people, but you're actually going to do more harm if you're not prepared. So that's one. And I think related to that is to know when you're not the right person for the job. to know when to say when in some ways, that there are other people who would be better suited for that. I mean, I think because people are trying to make a name for themselves, they sometimes may take on things that aren't appropriate and that they may not have the expertise for. And, you know, I mean, I think that's more relevant when you may be impacting other people. If it's a learning process, if it's a knowledge kind of based thing, then I think it's great to explore and not be afraid of delving into other realms. Trying to live the things in your own life is obviously a lesson.
Live things in your own life?
Well, live the principles that you're talking about that are associated with kind of conflict resolution. I think when you really feel like you understand conflict, you're in trouble. Because to me, I mean, conflict is one of those. I mean, what's so unique about it, and why I like this field so much, is because conflicts follow patterns, yes, but rarely are ever exactly the same. And so, there's a humility that we have to give to the process of conflict. We can't ever have the hubris enough to say that we understand conflict fully. At least that's my opinion, because then it keeps you humble. And you respect kind of the power of what conflict is and it's about. And then the last one is to think of the skills associated with this field broadly. That these are really, you know, they're life skills. They're skills that I know that since being in this field, my life has gotten easier. It's sort of, you know, I think about your life in general as, you know, you're on a ship and you're charting a, you know, you're weaving in and out of the course of life. And the skills involved in this help you do that, help you make the right tacks and help you make the right comeabouts and all the other kinds of boating terms that you might use. But I really have noticed a difference in my ability to deal with familial problems and professional problems. And it's just something that you have a repertoire of skills that you're not afraid to go into situations with. And I think that's, you know, that's one that, you know, when I teach classes on negotiation or train people in negotiation, I say, you know, I'd really like you to think broadly about negotiation. I mean, most people think about sitting down across a table, when in fact you're negotiating with people every day, all the time. And so if you think about the skills that are related to that and associated with that, then it very much makes sense that these, once you learn these things, they will lead to something that makes your life a little bit easier. And I think that's why it's caught on.
Yeah, I like that last concept of thinking about negotiation more broadly. I bet that strikes people when you say that.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, the reality is that they deal with their husband or wife, their children, their friends. And anytime they disagree, I mean, you've essentially engaged in a negotiation process. Yeah. You know, I mean, Bill in The Third Side kind of characterized, you know, people talk about the term homo sapiens. And he talks about it as homo negotiators, which I think is right. I think that people our entire existence has been about trying to figure out how the heck we live with each other. And now it's become, you know, it's cliche, and we talk about Rodney King and Can't We All Go, but really, you know, to get anything done, I mean, when you call somebody on the phone, it takes some form of cooperation for you to get what you need, because you can't do it without them. And so if you think about all the things in the course of your daily life that require some cooperation and some persuasion as to why what you're asking makes sense, then you're negotiating. Yeah. You know? So.
All right, man. Anything else you want to add to our conversation?
I don't think so. I think that's about it. I think I've talked you out.
Thank you for taking the time, John.
Sure.